Session. As you can see from our first session, we are in some ways scratching the surface of much deeper issues that hopefully will get us pondering and talking and thinking in the days ahead, and somewhat wide-eyed about the challenges that might be there as we begin to think about more intentional partnerships. But this next session is focused more on the opportunities that could be there by doing cooperative work. So we're going to turn positive, a little bit more positive. And I've asked Jeff Abbott to lead this. He's a phenomenal resource, as I said. I've just so much enjoyed talking to him. I'll go ahead and tell you, he's most likely going to hold back. The guy has a deep, deep well of experience and passion and knowledge for this. I hope you don't, brother. I hope you'll give us everything tonight. But because he was sent out by Timberlake as a missionary with no mission agency, but directly by the church, I think everything he speaks from his own sort of wisdom earned through the years. And so we couldn't have a better guy to talk to us about the idea of church-based sending and what are the challenges of that and what are the unique advantages of that. So I'm very grateful. Jeff serves at Timberlake Baptist Church. He oversees their Christian school and also oversees their missions program. And I don't know how long you've been there.
Well, I should have missed
it. Yeah, he'll give us all the background. So come on up, Jeff.
Here from a free time. No, I was going to say, as it pertains to the time frame, my wife and I, as Shane was mentioning, we'll backtrack a little bit on two things. One, I was originally on the schedule as first thing Tuesday morning. I'm thinking, that's fantastic. They come out fresh, ready to roll. I go from the best schedule to the worst schedule, end of the day and the first day after you've eaten. So excited about being here. I'm certainly not an expert in anything, but I'm passionate about it. So that makes up for perhaps other lackings. My wife and I, going back, just give a brief testimony a little bit from my background and why I'm here and how I came to this point in my life. Raised on a mission field. My parents were missionaries of France, went there a year old, 1970. And parents were... I love my father, very faithful man in ministry for many years on the field. From a very traditional independent Baptist background, when I came back to the States, got married, God gave me a very lovely wife who had a desire for ministry, and God placed on our hearts to go back to the mission field. And so I finished our studies at Tennessee Temple University. I named that school because in a few years it won't exist anymore. It doesn't exist already, but people will forget about it. Went to Liberty for Christian Education Masters, and from there went to Timberlake Baptist Church. So we were 21 and 22 years old at that time, and God gave me a desire. God gave us a desire to go serve in France. I was early on already very convictional about the role of the local church in ministry. Now, remind you, I'm coming from a very big Baptist board background, and I'm very convictional about. Not that you cannot have a board, but if I could not have a board and not have a third-party authority in that, I would like to work through that. So I went to my church and said, listen, we're getting ready to go. The church came back and said, man, we don't know how to do that. We're not comfortable with that right now. And so I went with a small board, Worldwide New Testament Baptist Missions in New Bern, North Carolina. Dr. Whetstone was the president there. They were very gracious. I went through their process, but I told them, if my church ever gives me the green light to go with them, you know I'm going to go with them. He says, we'll support that. So a year later, church came back and said, would you consider going into the church? I says, we'll do it. Pulled back out from the mission board and went with our local church. Coming from a big board background means that the president of my father's board came to me and encouraged us to join the board. When we would not, and we didn't give deep explanation as to why not, He shared with my parents his concern for us, told my brother that he shouldn't work with me because I wasn't reliable, I wasn't accountable to anyone, because I wasn't under a board. I had supporting pastors who called me and says, hey, a mission rep came and said, you know, you shouldn't support this guy because he doesn't have any accountability without a board. And so we walked through that process, and God has just gave me just a desire to have that very convictional about where the church fits into this. So now we come to a TES summit on missions. As Shane was saying, I mean, I'm tremendously blessed. This is my one opportunity to kind of share my heart about missions with you guys. For those of you who are here, we're passionate about the mission aspect. I've had these conversations with Bob Whitney back in, I think, 2019. We were at the Shepherd's Conference together, and I was sharing him a desire. I mean, what can TES kind of do together? Had a long conversation with Rick Holland, coming back from Israel. I had him stuck there 12 hours on the plane, right? And so we talked a long time about missions, and he said, well, you need to present something. And that was going back to, I think, 2022. So I've had this yearning, and the reason why, in 2013, we went back to the field. 2013, Brian Farrell asked if we'd consider returning to the States. We're in transition out of the ministry in France. We were in our second church plant that we'd help establish. We're ready to either start a new church plant or do something differently. And there's a lot of factors that brought us back, but one certainly is our church. There were our elders that said, would you consider doing this? So we came back. My training, and then later on, I got my D-Admin to increase that training and education, and came back in the school administrator. Timothy Christian School has been around since 1966. It's a school that does occupy a lot of my time. And then I have the Sunday school, and then I have missions, and I'm blessed to be part of all three. I tell people that I do what I love in life. I mean, I love education, I love missions, and I get to do both full time, and it's all blessing. Days are long, I get tired, but I never get weary in what I'm doing. That's for sure. So as I went through, came back off the field, I discovered in Brian the TS network. And I didn't know at the time that other people thought that way. I didn't. It's like, well, I was living in from a background of this independent world. I had my own convictions. I had grown away from that for different reasons. My father wanted to work with us, and I kind of shared with him why we were not going to be able to do that. I mean, I took positions that were, I have a great relationship with my father. I love him. We respect each other, but we just knew we're not on the same plane there. Came back and just discovered in Timberlake and TES just a network of congruent, like-minded men and churches that I did not even know really existed at the time. And so with that, coming here, my initial desire today, we're supposed to talk about obstacles to church-based coalitions, and certainly part of this addresses that. But I want to turn around a little bit and talk about more about the opportunities and answer some of these questions as to why church-based mission coalitions. I mean, why do this? Why push this question as to cooperating, working together? Are mission agencies not already doing? Are they not already suited for this? Reminds me of the conversations people had early on. We live in the backyard of Liberty University. How many people told our church, well, why do TS Seminary when we have a seminary right next door? Well, there was a reason for that, and part of that was the congruency, obviously, in what you're trying to accomplish. Second is because we're called to do it, and there's a biblical foundation, a biblical reason for that. So is it necessary? Is it helpful? What can the church do, and what must it do are questions that come out of this. So what I decided to do is build it this way, and no doubt I look at my material, and it's I got a clock up there. There's a lot more material here to cover than I've got time for, but this is my one shot to get it out, so I'm going to do my best to do so. I sat down and said, you know, here are five unique opportunities in church-based mission coalitions, and these are the needs I see from being in missions all these years, from being both sides of the fence, for seeing the culture that we're living in, for dealing with young couples who want to be involved in missions. Here's what I feel like a church unique opportunities that present themselves to us as a church-based mission coalition. The first one I put down is an opportunity to model strong ecclesiology. An opportunity to model strong ecclesiology. I think that the strongest passage for me when it comes to church-based, what you'll discover about me and people when you talk to missions and the church, what they'll discover about me is I'm obsessed with the local church and missions. Meaning that's the one non-negotiable that I'm going to hammer home. And everyone comes to me and they ask me a question about missions. my first question out of the gate is, where does this fit within the local church? I'm obsessed with that, and people get to know me now. They know exactly where I'm going to go with it. For me, the strongest passage for that really anchors my view on the local church is 1 Timothy, because 1 Timothy describes the church. Of course, first of all, it describes how you're supposed to behave in the household of God. So it's not going to Great Commission. The Great Commission will give me ideas on how to perform missions and how to be successful in missions. But 1 Timothy tells me why the local church is essential as a central aspect of mission. One, as we know, it describes in verse 15 of chapter 3, it describes the church as what? As the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and support, or pillar and buttress of truth. I like Guthrie's commentary on this text. He says that given the fact that there's no article in front of the word pillar or foundation, means that each church individually stands as a pillar and as a strength and as a support of truth. So what I walk away from this, and you could just develop this forever, but what this I walk away from this is this. The church is the pillar and support of truth. Once you remove missions, or the church rather, from missions, you remove the pillar that supports truth. And in doing so, you'll see all the, and we'll talk about that in just a minute when we see the mission culture, you'll see all the drifting that goes, pragmatism that builds in when the pillar of truth is removed from missions. Missions naturally tends to be pragmatic. We walk into the mission field, we want to be pragmatic because we want results, we want fruit, because what works, what doesn't. And if you move theologians away from that, and you move theology away from that, and you move the church away from that, the moment you move the church away from that, you naturally drift in a pragmatic efficiency thought process which takes you away from just a firm foundation of missions. You've heard this before, I'm sure. Poor ecclesiology leads to poor missiology. Without a doubt, weak ecclesiology is at the heart of most missionary short-term and long-term failures on two fronts. One, on the missionary front himself, and two, on strategy and missional strategies. Meaning when there's a poor presence of the church and there's poor ecclesiology in the process, there's going to be poor missiology as an outcome of that. If you look at most missionary statistics, and you've read them, you've seen them, what does it say about missionaries? The success rate of missionaries, just as part as not what they're accomplishing, but just their ability to stay and function on the field. You'll see different numbers. You'll see Mission Nexus says 71% of missionaries leave the field for preventable reasons. Most stats show that roughly 50% of missionaries don't make it past their first term. When you look at why, what I find interesting is that when you look at why missionaries leave, Q&A time, we'd have time for this, but you'd have what? You hear often conflict with coworkers, broken marriages. I've had one coworker leave the field because his son came back to the States, joined the Marines, got in substance abuse, and got an armed robbery. Next you know, he's an armed robbery. He takes a hostage on the way out. So now he's got armed robbery hostage. And he's still in jail in Florida, and my coworker came home to care for him and because he felt like he wasn't qualified to be a missionary anymore because of that. Other coworker, wife left him, worked with him for years, and his wife left him, said, "No, I'm done. I'm done with ministry." I mean, the amount of devastation on the field on the backside, it's one thing to have the glamorous front end, but on the back end, you see statistically that missionaries deal with life tragedies, wayward children, unmet expectations, discouragement, depression, sin strongholds, lack of accountability, discipleship, lack of preparation sometimes, and all these things. You know what the key? It's amazing. You go to books. Greer writes a good book on mission drift, but he has one small section where he says at the end, and by the way, the local church is important. When in reality, every one of these issues can be the church is uniquely designed to handle and to address. But because the missionaries are not tethered to the church, they face difficulty and challenges that unfortunately we're not able to come alongside them and be a part of. So two things I want to talk about. Being a coalition of churches allows us to develop strong ecclesiology together, because poor ecclesiology is going to lead to poor missiology. And then together, collaboratively, I think we can model a church that is a church-centric mission model on a much broader level and a much deeper level than each individual church could do on their own. As iron sharpens iron, I believe that together we can foster a healthy missions model. Let me say this, too. I don't know many of you guys well. I know some of you by name. Most of you don't know me well at all. So that's a good thing, because if I offend you, and I know it's not intentional because I don't know your specifics. So I might step on a few toes. I don't mean to. Just take it as someone who's just convictional about the missional aspect of things and not trying to press an agenda when I do this. I'm just speaking from what I feel like biblically is a model that we need to proclaim loud and clear. And frankly, I don't know of a better place to do that than within churches who already understand the value of common ground in some of these areas. The second part, we've been talking about mission agencies a little bit. I'm not going to get on that hobby horse very long, because I'm not suggesting that mission organization agencies are bad and evil or not necessary. One friend described it this way. He says, you know, an agency is like an airline. If Delta takes me from Atlanta to Roanoke, that's good. But if I don't like the way they do it, I go on another airline, because ultimately the goal is to get to Roanoke, not the airline. What happens in agencies is that they become their own family, and they become their own agenda. They become their own, and they develop a very closed-knit environment that is not always conducive to what you're trying to do with the church. So I put down the poor ecclesiology leads to poor paramissional organizations. Now, normally we use the term parachurch. I make a distinction between parachurch and paramissional, because a parachurch organization for me is like Samaritan Purse. They come alongside, help feed food banks, clothe, thrift stores, things that come and help the needy. Paramissional organizations are those who, like team missions, come alongside and says, our goal is to go and plant churches. So I make a distinction between parachurch organization as a whole and what I call paramissional organization, who claim to come and do what Shane was describing earlier. They actually claim to come do what the church is designed to do, and that presents another challenge. My suggestion is this with this paramissional or parachurch organization, is that they'll claim that the reason why they stepped in is because the church has not stepped in, right? They're claiming, they'll make the claim that the reason why we're doing what we're doing is because the church is not doing it. The danger with that, obviously, is that the weaker the church is, the stronger the paramissional organization becomes. And the more silent we are, the more vocal they are. And so it's much more efficient and helpful for us together to understand what we stand for in missions and speak in that way, to have relationships with mission organizations that allow us to say, yes, we understand your role and your responsibilities, but here is what we would like from you, and here's our expectations from you. That's a much harder thing to do on an individual basis, because not that we don't have leverage as a group versus one church, but the reality is mission organizations, they say all the right things, but functionally, how you see how it functions behind, ultimately, I've seen it on the other side. I mean, I've seen the language and the way they describe the church. It's amazing how on the other side of missions, they describe the church as incompetent, not lacking knowledge, lacking will, lacking the means, and not knowing what they're doing. People within our own church encourage others, well, you know, Timberlake, they just don't know what they're doing with missions. You know, you got to trust the professionals. And the more silent the church is, the more the professionals think they have the space to occupy that space without us saying, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, I appreciate the ministry you're doing, but here's where us as a church needs to step in and do the work that we're called to do. Historically, it's a little bit grieving, because William Carey is a hero. My brother's name is, middle name is Carey, after William Carey. Father of Modern Missions. I mean, The Inquiry is great. It's a great book. A lot of great things about what William Carey did, but unfortunately what he also did is start the First Baptist Missionary Society. What he also did is separate the church from missions. What he also did is start raising a penny a week for missions, raising funds outside the church. What he also established is now, a couple hundred years later, we have 2 million nonprofits in the U.S. who function, many of them would be described functioning as more as corporate America more than the church, and they do so, and in doing so, they're still addressing what we'd call missional work, and they cover areas that belong to the church. I don't consider myself to be in opposition to them. I just feel like I have the right and expectation to expect of them transparency. We could all give examples of failed mission organizations. My experience is that they have a conflict of interest when they get a certain size. The better mission organizations are probably the smaller ones who still have that pioneering spirit of helping the church. As a mission organization get larger, they have large headquarters. They take 15% of the support from their missionaries, and they have to sustain the system. And I'm not saying, I don't mean to make it sound that critical. I think it's just a reality that now, you know, we had a missionary in China. I was sharing it with Aaron coming in. There was one of our missionaries, and we hadn't seen him in a couple of years. He's in China, and they come home and find out that he's been physically abusing his wife. There is terrible things going on within the family, moral things. It was, the mission knew about it for 2 years. They feel like they're going to handle it internally. Well, there's a number of reasons for that. One, one missionary that has 40 supporting churches, that spreads and all these things. And what I've discovered about missions as a whole, and maybe even agencies and organizations, these examples we're given are not the exception. They become the norm. Don't think that these abuses and these things that we're talking about are like the fringe. They're not the fringe. It becomes really mainstream. And so with the desire for us as churches is to how to relate to missional, paramissional organizations is important for us to establish, one, what should be expected of us. And I'll tell this to people all the time. I want to partner with missionaries. I don't believe in the pay and pray model. Churches are not there just to pay and pray for missions. And how can we be much more intentionally involved? And that's my desire, and that's my goal in addressing that from a church perspective. Two, an opportunity to counter the current. Sorry, my throat is really dry tonight. Some say when you get older, your throat gets dry, but I refuse to get older, so that can't be the problem. An opportunity to counter the current missional culture. I say this because even within our churches, people who are under the teaching of expository teaching year in and year out are still utterly confused about missions and the role of the church in missions. And you could think, well, they're gonna gain this and they're going to absorb this. They're not, because that mission culture, if you read all this mission literature, it'd be very difficult to find mission literature that is consistently congruent with what you would like to see. Mark 9 is probably one that's really advanced the ball and doing a lot of great things in the literature piece, but so much of it, they'll say so many good things, but then they'll throw something in there that totally undermines the local church and its ability to do what it's doing. It's amazing to me that it does that. And this culture that we live in, now we're in the backyard of Liberty University. Oh my goodness. That means you have all these students who come in here who want to be involved in missions, they want to be involved in ministry, and they feel this calling. And what we discover with missions is I'll share some of these quotes here in just a minute, but there are real life implications to the culture, the mission culture that we're facing. Here I quoted Sam Metcalf. Sam Metcalf is difficult to read for me because he's so anti-church. And he reflects a culture around the idea of the local church. And what he describes, he says the tensions that exist between churches and agencies exist because of narrow-minded pastors with an aberrant ecclesiology. This is a culture that these kids are reading, are self-absorbed about their personal calling to missions outside of the church. And all they want from the church is that we come and affirm it. He goes on to talk about what he calls the supremacy of the local church, or he calls it also reductionist ecclesiology, which means we're reducing missions to the local church. Now, I'm so fired up about the church, I read him, I'm like, I'm texting Brian, can you believe what this guy's saying? You know, it's because I can't, basically, describing it comes to the point in missions in our culture that they blame the local church for holding missions back. And it hits close to home. I mentioned earlier, you could have a young person raised in your church that understands the centrality of the church, understands the role of elders, and yet when it comes to being called to missions, they quickly find, and you as a church, quickly find yourself in the back seat. Even once they find themselves on the field, they're challenged. I've witnessed this, you certainly have. So what I would suggest is that we have an opportunity together. We have an opportunity together to help counter and cultivate a culture that is a biblical mission culture and one that counters the existing one. One of the primary topics that comes with that is mission culture as it pertains to the missionary call. This is certainly the fer de lance, as the French would say, which means the tip of the spear. This is certainly in missions, this notion of where does a missionary call come from? A few things come with that. Schnabel here, he's certainly a reference point in a lot of mission literature. He says, to be a missionary, there needs to be one who sends and one who goes. George Murray, he also has a good quote. He says, missionaries don't just go to the lost, they're sent to the lost. The key piece about mission culture, first of all, is that missionaries are sent by the church. And I hammer that home every chance I get to our church and our church people. Missionaries are sent by the church. I believe personally that the word apostle is probably a good description of what a missionary does. He's a sent one. He's a messenger of the church. Yes, he plays the role of an evangelist. I think the term apostle describes, as I mentioned, one that is sent by the church, one that is a messenger of the church. I think we see that with Barnabas in 2 Corinthians 8. I think we see that with Epaphroditus in Acts 14 as well. So I like the term apostle for that. But we're fighting a culture that does not understand that the role of the church, even the church, to understand is my responsibility to send. Even if I use an agency, which it might necessitate an agency based on what we're doing and where we're going, even if I'm going to use an agency, it's my responsibility to send. A missionary doesn't go. He is first and foremost sent by the church. I know we're convictional about this, and I'm sure you believe and agree with these things as well. Missionaries are affirmed by the church. This is a little harder. Okay, we're sent by the church. So someone comes to you and they say, "Well, listen, I feel called to missions, and so would you send me?" Young couple like that. This last week, I talked to the guy on Sunday. I cannot send him. He is ill-equipped to go. His wife is ill-equipped to go. I told him, says, "You know, listen, I love you guys. I would love to help you, but he's not ready to do the hard work to really prepare himself to be elder qualified for the task he wants to do in Ecuador. He's been married for 3 years. His wife just recently got baptized because for 2 years she struggled as to whether or not she should, as a Presbyterian, be baptized again by immersion. He struggled. He came to me struggling of how to fill out the doctrinal application for ABWE. I said, "Listen, brother, we're not in a place today. If you want to go to the field this coming year, we're not going to be able to play that role." So it's shocking to them. I mean, they've been in church for years. They've been hearing me say this, but they expect that because they have a missionary calling, a missionary desire, the role of the church is to bless you, brother, and go, and yet it's much more than that. It's not just sending them, yes, but it's also affirming them. What I put down here, what I found interesting, as you walk through Acts, though not prescriptive as it is, nevertheless, as you see those who are called, if you will, you see Acts 11, Barnabas, he's going to be called to go to Cyprus. Of course, he's from Cyprus, so that makes sense, but he's going to be told to go there and see the effect of the gospel in Cyprus. Acts 13, very familiar passage where they choose Paul and Barnabas to go. In Acts 15, Paul chooses Silas to go with him. Acts 16, Paul goes and chooses Timothy. The reason why I got these passages is simply this. Never in Scripture do you see someone that says, "I've got a call to do this, would you send me?" You always see the initiative being on someone saying, "Let me affirm and send you." Now, not suggesting there isn't a call that comes with that, and I've got a couple thoughts on on how to navigate that. But when someone comes to me and desires to be involved in ministry, one of the first things they say is usually, you know, we feel called to missions. Well, lo and behold, how do you argue with God? I mean, if you got a call, I'm not God, and I'm not going to argue you got a call, so let me help you affirm your calling. So how do we discern a call to ministry and a call to mission specifically? One is through qualified church leadership. There's two aspects. On one hand, there's a subjective call, which is this conviction, this deep burden for, this passion. So there's this subjective call on one end. At the same time, on the other end, it's tested by biblical elders. So what you want to see in a biblical call is you want to see someone who has a desire, same way you would with an elder. What's the first question about you go to an elder? You know he's qualified, but what's the first question? Does he have a desire to be an elder? So there is going to be this desire that's placed in them, but that desire is in what? Affirmed with elders that are going to see as this person qualifies. So those two pieces need to marry and come together. The congregation that knows the candidate must objectively recognize gifts, strengths, and abilities. It seems that the Lord is calling me, needs to be balanced with, it seems that the Lord has set you apart and wants us to send you. Those two pieces have to balance each other. This mystical call from someone is not sufficient if it's not balanced with a objective recognition. I talked to a missionary just last week on the phone, and I said, listen, you have to understand, we took you on and supported you because your elders affirmed you. If you're telling me you're walking away from your elders, then I cannot affirm you. You don't serve here. It's not on your one visit or your preaching. It says I have to rely on the biblical foundation that your elders are going to affirm what you're doing. And if they don't affirm you, I cannot support you. That's a painful conversation to someone that feels like they're doing God's work and they have this call. What I would suggest is that either they settle their issues with their elders, or if their elders are not biblical elders, then find a church that will affirm you biblically and properly, if that were the case. Now, it's not the recommendation I gave him, but I like what Bruce Waltke says. He narrows it down this way. He says, a call is an inner desire given by the Holy Spirit through the Word of God and confirmed by the community of Christ. He provides three ingredients here. One, the Holy Spirit that provides a desire. He provides the Word of the Lord, the biblical principles surrounding that, and then the work of the church through elder shepherding. Two other quotes that I feel like are really good. This is hard for a young generation to hear. I share this with some of our college kids, and they don't embrace this readily. He says, Walsh says that the call originates with God, is discerned, is declared, and it is ratified by the church. Without that ratification, there is no vocation. Last one is almost offensive. An individual from Griffin, he says, an individual can express his willingness while others must determine his worthiness. The individual may be free to go, but only his church knows if he is really fitted to go. That's brutal. If you walk in with this current culture of God's called me, I want to serve. And listen, when people come, I'm very gracious with them because they're expressing the desire to serve the Lord and the best way they know. But they're immersed in a culture that feeds them this. And they think that because they have this sense of and I've heard all kinds of mystical callings. I've seen all kinds of description of what it means, from seeing Jesus in a cloud that must have been a sign to us praying about it. And I heard a song on the radio, and all these mystical things that the church is supposed to simply say amen to. No, we've been called not just to send, but we've been called to affirm. And ultimately, what I tell our people is that someone's not able to go, not just because they want to go, but until the church said they're fit to go. And that's a much higher bar and a much greater responsibility that falls on us. So what I would suggest for us simply is that we have an opportunity, yes, individually as churches, to affirm the role of the church, some of the non-negotiables for me in mission, that the church must affirm and must send the missionary. I have one young lady, sweet girl, and I told her, man, I wish my daughters were like you, want to serve the Lord in China as a teacher. But she came to me with already been approved by a mission agency. They never contacted me. They never verified anything. I never filled it. Never done nothing. But she comes to me with already their approval to go. I said, listen, I've seen that over and over. That's what I'm saying. This is not the fringe. This is the norm. Young lady in our school, World Life. World Life, my wife went to World Life. I don't say too much in front of her because it gets personal. But World Life is a good organization and many things they do. They send me, so a missionary comes, a young lady I knew from our school, graduated. She comes to me, she got her prayer card for More Life, everything. Then she asked me, I always go back down my lanes. I know my parameters. I said, well, let me ask, what do your elders think about it? Oh, I haven't asked them yet. I says, let me ask you. I appreciate what you're trying. I'm gracious. I may sound harsh here. I'm not. I'm gracious. I says, listen, man, I really appreciate your heart to serve the Lord. It's a beautiful thing. I'm glad you went to World Life for 2 years and were trained there and know the word. I said, but you really went backwards on this. And so why don't you go to your elders and see if they affirm what you want to do, then maybe we can talk. It amazes me, the language. And now World Life particularly, I have a little bit grievance with, because the way they train their missionaries is to, you know, they train them to do people, what they call friend raising. They train them to work outside the church and raise money through individuals, and that comes into your churches. So that's another issue there. But, yeah, the grieving aspect of bypassing, because ultimately, fundamentally, philosophically, we feel like the church somehow is holding me back from doing God's work. I think together, yes, individually, we can push back on that. But, boy, we can do that so much more efficiently when we learn together to articulate this and develop a culture around that. The same way we've done, yes, with TES training, we could do that with missions and help counter this culture and develop things, maybe even get into writing at some point to help us counter this self-culture that pushes missions in these ways. Third thing I put down is an opportunity to support congruent biblical missions. Mentioned earlier in my testimony how hard it is to find churches who believe in the centrality of the church, of the local church in missions. Everyone's going to acknowledge the role of the church. Everyone's going to say the church is important. Everyone says they wish the church were more involved. I mean, I have a friend who graduated from they came from our church. They're in Poland right now. I asked him, hey, my question. So, what do your elders think about this? Who's your home church? Well, if I were to choose a home church, I think it would be so-and-so church because they're really behind us. I says, man, Thomas, I says, let me just tell you, I've got to have elders I can talk to that affirm the ministry you have. I love you, brother. I've known you for 20 years. I've got to have a church that affirms. Culturally, they don't understand that. It's so important, so vital that we build a missional model that's where we're congruent. This is an opportunity for us to build and support congruent biblical missions. You've heard these things. This is not new. I know every issue we face is a theological issue on one level or another. It's interesting about mission history. Great Commission, The Great Commission Resurgence. Excellent book. Chuck Lawless and Adam Greenaway, two Southern Baptists. They wrote a book on why the Southern Baptist. I went to Southern, so I had to read some Southern stuff. It's amazing. I went to Southern and still did my thesis on the exclusivity of the local church and mission. So that got me a few conversations with my teacher, but that was all right. They wrote a great, but they came to one conclusion about missions. And in this case, the Southern Baptist Church specifically, is that they said the problem is that theology, I think I didn't put it in my notes here. They concluded that Jesus did not give the Great Commission to a mission board. He gave these marching orders to his disciples and through them to his church. And the conclusion they have is that what happened in Southern Baptist Church is that missions started to be a separate branch from theology in the church. And the moment you started separating theology and missions, the mission started drifting. Peter Greer writes on the missional drift from a Southern perspective as well, with that in mind as well. To support congruent biblical missions means to have sound theology at the heart of what we're doing and why we're doing what we're doing. That is the exception. It's not the norm. Maybe in our TS bubble, I mean that in a negative way, but in our TS world, we feel like everyone's talking the same language. You walk into the mission world, we're not talking that language. The culture is pushing against it, the idea that sound theology, and when you do that, and you pull the church away, the pillar of truth, that means you're pushing theology away, and then you lead down this negative path for missions that, to me, has a lot of negative, obviously, ramifications. I think together we just have an opportunity to build a congruent theology, to develop together on a congruent biblical missions model. Missions not shaped by expediency, because what happens was when theology is pulled away, then missions is shaped by expediency, pragmatism, human allegiances, not sound theology, and the conviction that the Word of God is sufficient even in missions. If I'll talk faster. One thing about being in France, the French talk fast. So when I came back, the people say, you talk too fast. That's okay. The French do that, no doubt. It's an opportunity to train and affirm missionaries. I don't think here that I have to say much, because I think we already agree here that we know the value and we understand the importance of training together. And the reason why TS was started is because we saw the need to pull resources together with congruent churches to establish sound theology together. I think we need to do that in missions. I think sometimes the danger, Joel James said something that's really good, said something along the lines that a missionary is a theologian with a passport. I think he said something along those lines. That's good, unless you're saying that he could walk out of a seminary degree and walk into the mission field and not have a problem. That's a problem. In the same way we understand that the reason why we have church training within the church is because they need to be under the shepherding care. In the same way, if we're going to put somebody in a cross-cultural ministry and embrace those different kind of challenges, it's different to be in an oppressive society. There's a lot of other challenges that come with that. How valuable it would be to create an environment where we can be intentional about preparing people to be missionaries within sound, congruent churches. I think it is vital. I think it would be something that would help us, because right now we have young men who want to be to the field. They don't understand exactly what's the exclusive role of the church in this. They have their TS training, and they don't know how to bridge that gap and how to go from here. I think there's a place for us to not necessarily create another agency. That's not what I'm suggesting here. What I am suggesting, though, is that we can be perhaps intentional in structuring, perhaps training places overseas where they can do 6-month training, whatever it is, other things we could talk about, but something that's intentional about helping us together train and affirm missionaries. Lastly, it's an opportunity to be strategic in missions, and we've talked about this already a little bit. Three parts of missions I like to hammer on a little bit. Three things that should shape our decisions. How are we strategic in missions? Shane mentioned some of that. Do we go where they need more translation? Do we go where the percentages of people are low, the evangelical world, are small numbers? You can't read a Joshua Project without being moved. I mean, 2%, 0%, some countries, 0, 1.1%. France still shows 2% evangelical. You can't read those numbers and not be grieved. I mean, you're heavy for the weight of the world and the need for the gospel. But there's one presuppositional truth in missions that is vital, and that's God is sovereign in missions. And the reason why that's important, for a number of reasons, but if we don't have that seriously anchored in our thoughts, we're going to chase after what we feel is the greatest need because somehow God is in need over here or in need over there. I can't believe how many books I've read where it talks about God is like a needy God. Like, you know, oh, this country over here is not reached because, boy, no one's been willing to go yet. I mean, what kind of God are we describing that is like some kind of impotent God waiting for us to be faithful? God is not waiting for us to be faithful in anything. God is entirely sovereign and independent. He didn't start, oh, great, I could reach France because Jeff went over there. I discovered God was already at work, and I was blessed to be part of what he was doing. But if we don't understand that, if we don't understand God's sovereignty in missions, we chase after the latest news, the latest emotional felt need, instead of being more thought provoke of as to what we need to be doing and where we need to be going. I'm trying to see from my notes what I need to cut off. Christopher Wright says this, we're seeking to accomplish what God himself wills to happen. This is both humbling and reassuring, for we know that behind all of our fumbling efforts stands the supreme will of the living God. So three aspects about being strategic in missions. One is understand the sovereignty of the Lord in missions, to where we're using wisdom decisions, not chasing after emotions. Two, we're looking for success in missions. Successful missions come from the Great Commission. Go, baptize, teach, make disciples. We were saying earlier with Chris, you know, the making disciples in the Great Commission, again, I know I'm not teaching you guys this, but in the Great Commission, the only imperative is make disciples. The rest of those words there are adverbial support to make disciples. So whether you're in going in that phase, whether you're in the baptizing phase, I like it, the fact that there's no salvation phase because God does a saving, right? We go, he does a saving, and we baptize, and we teach, and we make disciples. Ultimately, that aspect of making disciples has to drive every aspect of why we're doing what we're doing strategically. How does this fulfill the Great Commission of making disciples? So if I'm going to go and serve as a doctor in this hospital, okay, but how is this going to fulfill the Great Commission? Another missionary young couple wanted to go to Argentina with World Life. I said, listen, if you're going to go to Argentina with Life, for me, you got to tell me, you got to connect with the local church, you're going to have to help grow the church and build disciples in the church. He went, came back, talked to World Life. They says, no, we need you as a house parent. You don't have time to do that. I said, sorry. I'm telling you, I come across very harsh, I'm sure. Here's my parameters. Making disciples is ultimately, even if you're going over there to do this or that, making disciples is what is success in missions, and we have to be strategic about that. Yes, planting churches is what leads to that, but that's a discussion for another day. Last one I'll put down simply is strategic missions. So here's four questions I ask myself when it comes to where do we go, what do we do? I mean, talk about the numbers, you know, China, yes, they got 1 billion people, but they also have 7 to 8% evangelical, 100 million perhaps. Papua New Guinea, 23% evangelical. Brazil, I mean, I ran into Brazilian missionaries in France. We sent somebody to Niger, he ran into Korean missionaries in Niger. So it's amazing to see what the Lord has done and what the Lord is doing. Four questions I simply ask ourselves. One, what is God already doing? The old model, which is probably my parents' model, was you spin the globe and you put your finger down, we're going to go here. And, I mean, I know it sounds a little bit nuts, but, I mean, it's kind of like wasn't the internet, wasn't everything we have today. You can't do all the strategic planning. Just, I don't know of anything in this city. It's a big city. Let's go. Anybody know about it? I don't know anything there, and we go. Today, I think we're a lot more strategic about, okay, what is God already doing there? Are there believers looking for, do we know of believers that are needing to be trained, needing to be formed into a church? Is it even if it's a brand new area, is it an area where other parts of the country have evangelical believers that want to reach that area? When I went to Nepal and went to Kathmandu and talked to the pastor there on the back wall, he had their goal for 1,000 church plants across Nepal. That's what I want to see. Then you can go in an area where they need a church plant, but you're joining people that have a desire for that, and you're joining your efforts to theirs. Now, not every country has these things, but I have found that there's a lot more going on than we realize. So first of all, what is God already doing? What has God provided? Meaning, within our church, Michael Lowry, we sent to China. I mean, he married, you know, he was trained in the Chinese language. He speaks the Chinese. He's super sharp. He was trained with TS. He goes over there, right time, right place, doing the right work. It's part of what God gave us. So I'm not going to send Michael to France, even though I would like to see Michael in France, but Michael speaks Chinese. So Michael's going to go to China. I mean, what has God equipped us with? What has he given us? And what do we do with the skill sets and the resources that have been provided? Three, what is the need? What is the need, meaning, you know, as basic as that sounds, missionaries, a lot of times, we're Americans. And Americans are very goal-oriented, right? We want to charge the hill. We have our 3-year plan, our 5-year plan. We're going to build this. We're going to do that. Man, when I went to, I think it was in Zambia. Maybe it was in Malawi. You go to the compound. You go to the compound, what do you see? We're meeting in a really roughly run-down building. Next door to the building, brand-new building. I'm thinking, I asked one of the Malawians, why are we, what's going on with these buildings? He says, well, it's easy to raise money for a new building. No one wants to raise money for these old buildings. So they keep money running in. They keep building, they got these large compounds, and they keep building new things because that's how they raise money. It's like the strategy behind it is not you go in there, what do you need? We do things that fit our need. A sense of, man, we're doing something, we're building something, we like to build. Americans like to build, we're builders. You know, so we go in, well, we want to do this, we want to do that, and we want to convince them of what they need. What is the need? I think when we go there and you survey and you discuss and you find out what can really help and you find out how you can really meet that need. And the last question is, what is being done to facilitate disciples? I'm always obsessed with, okay, well, what are we doing to make disciples? How is this going to lead to better disciples? And keep that on the forefront of every missional engagement. Last question then for us. We ask this question, maybe you ask this question to many young couples, you know, we talk about getting married, and we ask them, Brian taught me that question in premarital counseling, would you be better for the kingdom than apart? That's my question for us. Would we be better together for the kingdom than apart? I think we know that answer for theological training. I think for us to have that question for missions would be healthy as well. Would we be better together for the kingdom in our missional efforts than we would apart? I think, because what I'm facing, what I see, and all these hurdles that we see there, that this would provide for us an opportunity to speak truth, to build a coalition of congruent churches that would help answer these questions the culture is facing, to be strategic in training with that. I know this is just the first place to discuss this. I would think that from a TS summit, what would I would like to for us to at least consider talking about? One, it begins with a desire to fulfill the Great Commission, not apart but together. It begins with not being so locked into being independent that we don't know how to be interdependent. And it begins with not being afraid of the challenges, but seizing on the opportunities and challenges there will be, and there are many. So, Shane, I appreciate you allowing me to kind of throw it all out there in one time, so that way if I never get invited and talk again, I get it all out at once. But, the blessing, I love missions. We love to entertain questions. I don't know what you want to do from here, Shane.
Just two things I wanted to follow up and punctuate. I mean, thank you so much for all that. That whole aspect of sovereignty is in some ways so obvious for us who are all Calvinistic churches. But even though we have some reform-minded mission agencies, I don't think that every reform-minded person nor every reform-minded church thinks through the implications of God's sovereignty in their ministry philosophy. And I don't think these mission agencies think through the sovereignty of God in their missions philosophy. Mm-hmm. So to put that at the center of kind of what you're talking about, I think is really highlights one of the things that is an opportunity for us and a frustration sometimes working with mission agencies is we, I think, as churches have tried to do that in our ministry, local ministry philosophy, and there's an opportunity to really, really do that in a missions philosophy. Because what you described is what I encounter all the time. Everyone's emotionally driven. They're moved as they read this and in this or that about this need or that country or something like that. And they just assume that therefore that's how we need to govern our missions rather than with a robust understanding of God's sovereignty.
And it undermines training.
Yeah,
because it undermines the need for long preparation because you got to hurry up and get there and fix a problem.
Yeah. I think the other thing you said right there at the end that I think we need to contemplate is, you know, the willingness on the part of the churches to go beyond our independence and think about interdependence is the right word. I forgot what word you used. But you know, we are... I think we have cultures that are sometimes fiercely independent, and sometimes for a good reason because of negative experiences that we've had. But to do that is going to require trust between the churches on a missional level. And so, you know, it's going to require even a little bit of risk to do that. So it kind of gets to my first question here for you. Like, what do you think, if you could talk about what is the biggest danger to forming a coalition, what would it be, and how could we mitigate that from the beginning?
You go back to the emotional aspect of things. Because it's an emotional issue, it's hard to keep that out of the equation when you're sitting down trying to be strategic about where to go, what to do. So it does take a lot of deferring. It takes a lot of coming together. I mean, what we'll discover is that there are no doubt projects that we can come together on and work together. But I think, you know, that phrase, I had a French pastor come to me, and I asked him, what do you think is the greatest challenge to French churches? He said, American missions. He says, you Americans are so independent that you don't know how to be interdependent. Mm. So I think we're so afraid that we're going to step on each other's autonomy, indigenous church, that we don't know how to sit down and let that be challenged. I think that first culture there is certainly a challenge.
Yeah. Let me maybe ask another one here. What would you think would be a healthy decision-making process for a coalition of churches for strategically choosing mission fields together? What would a healthy process look like with a coalition of churches? I mean, we have a sense of how we do that internally, but if I had to work with other churches, what would be involved in that decision making?
I would take it from an inductive reasoning, not deductive reasoning. So I don't start with where is the greatest need. I start with what do we have, and from there, what has God given us? That could be resources. That could mean people with experience on a certain field. It could be what has God equipped us with, and from there, okay, so where do we go? Because otherwise, if you start with just in missions, everybody's trying to market missions. So mm-hmm. It used to be 1040 window, then it was the unreached people group, then it was the most one missionary. Everybody tried, you know, I'm going to the most unreached of the unreached. I'm like, wow. It's like, now where do you go from there? You know, so we're not trying to go inductively. What do we have? What has God equipped us with? What has He put the burden in our heart for? And we have natural ties with Italy, with Matt. We have natural ties now with Tom Drian in London. How can we pour into him? So that's where I start out with.
Okay. All right. Very good. You just make me think of so many stories from my own sort of brief stint in missions that just add to everything you said. I really appreciate it. Wish I had time to share all those. But do you guys have other questions that you want to ask specifically about either opportunities for mission coalitions, things that you've been thinking about, or obstacles, things that you worry about when it comes to sort of, if you will, expanding beyond your independence as a church as you think about partnering with other churches? Yeah, so the question is, if we were to form a more formal organization, how do we prevent from becoming the mission organization that we are currently criticizing?
The mission organizations already have the platform. So I would not want to not step into that world by fear I become like them when they already occupy the space. So yeah, it will take, in the same way, every year at the Courageous Churchman, Jerry reminds people of staying tethered to the Word, then that's the advantage of having a coalition of churches, that we can encourage each other to stay tethered to the Word and stay true to the Word and mission. I think together we can do that better than being pieced apart. So I think, if anything, being a coalition of churches allows you to keep that congruency in the Word and not become what these things you don't want to become. I think you do that better when you speak in truth into your life than you are than you are a part.
And you talked about how when a mission agency reaches a certain size, it has to start feeding the beast.
Right.
And one of the things I think that we are thinking about is that this is fairly self-contained. You know, we're staying within the TES network. So hopefully we never outgrow or outstrip the right. coalition of churches. We don't need a headquarters. We don't need a lot of overhead and all those other things. We're looking at a way of just coordinating amongst ourselves that has a sort of a self-limiting vision, at least the way I think about what the possibilities would be.
And then you're served, basically, it's a means to take men that are within your TES environment and help them on-ramp into missions the same way we try to on-ramp them into the pulpit and to shepherding roles and help them go to the field. And then with that provide as a TES, why are we having TES alumni? Well, it's to have that support group, right, for people who are gone on ministry from TES. So I think there are ways to be intentional about that. And like you're saying, it's when the organizations get larger that they start existing for themselves more than they do for maybe their initial desire of just support.
Yeah, at some extent, the school is a representation of that. I mean, we are kind of self-limiting. We're not going to have buildings, big capital campaigns and stuff like that for that, because we operate very much within the context of the church, and I think the mission arm could model itself to some extent after that. It's going to be limited in the administrative side of it because we're just not going to need to have that as much as somebody else would. Other questions? Richard?
First of all, just want assurances that we wouldn't call this a cooperative program.
Okay.
So in my mind,
let me repeat the question for the recording. He's asking, not so much from the church's side, but from the missionary side, if we had a coalition that was working more closely, how would that affect the missionary's experience on the field? How would he interact with this larger coalition as opposed to just his sending church?
So in my mind, I have a 3 to 5 year plan of how you get to this. The first phase is right now, if we cooperate, it's I just discover.
Yeah, it's information sharing.
Information. So the first phase is information sharing. I don't even know what each church is doing. If I want to support somebody, I would want to go with a congruent church. I don't even know what each church is doing. So it's not even a platform for me. So I discover by talking, maybe at Courageous Church. Oh, you get so and so. Yeah, we're looking for so. Oh, that sounds great. So right now we're doing things on an organic way that can help really exponentially grow that. Secondly, what you would do, for example, when I go to Zambia or Malawi, then you have the opportunity to, hey, Shane, I'm going to go to Malawi. You've got a missionary there. Can I bring him something? Can I check in on him? He remains the person. He's not answering to me. But it's amazing how my observation, his observation, another brother that's supporting my observation, and then together say, hey, this is what's going on with this brother. Because missionaries, it's a two-edged sword. They get support from multiple churches, so ultimately they answer to no one, and it's convenient for everybody. One, it's convenient for churches because they don't really have big responsibility to one person, but don't forget, it's convenient for the missionary because no one church really knows what they're doing. Well, when Shane says, you know, we got so-and-so over there, we've got some concerns, here's what they are, then all of a sudden you're collaborating and holding people accountable and encouraging them. And then whenever we have the opportunity to be there, it just creates a much tighter network that we can support, encourage, hold accountable, help to be strategic, bring additional resources. I think it just brings that to a much different degree than when you're just by yourself trying to do something.
And I think I could add to that, you know, as I've thought about this, as we've had some conversations about this, it really does impact more on the front end. you know, the preparation, the selection, preparation, strategic thinking side as you're working together with other churches. When the missionaries sent out, as Jeff's saying, you know, it still is primarily their sending church that is overseeing them, but this is just trying to get more front-end coordination, front-end training. So you mentioned just finding out what everybody's doing. We have an idea of, first of all, just listing all the missionaries that are in one location of all of our TES churches, and then potentially if they have a need, a job, asking them to write a job description that we could post on the TES website so that graduates could read those and consider whether or not they might be the right person to fulfill that job. So that's in that informational stage that Jeff's talking about. But a lot of what we are at least contemplating right now is mostly on the front end before the missionary ever leaves, how we can coordinate to train, to talk, to strategize, you know, all that other stuff. Once they get there, I do think the experience won't change that much, at least the way I'm envisioning this.
Yeah, it's not so much trying to, it's not at all, I should say, trying to create some kind of centralized system. What it is trying to create harmony and voices that echo and support in the same direction so that we're more intentional about pulling in the same direction in areas that are difficult. I mean, today, a missionary, on average, raises $120,000 a year. On average, there's a lot of challenges that are there. It'd be great to have a choir singing and echoing these things. We're not talking about a centralized authority. We're talking about harmonizing. But to do that, we need to start having conversations and allow us to be strategic and develop strategic partnerships within that network.
Yeah, one thing that I did mention with Jeff a while back that could change the missionary's experience on the field is perhaps setting up formal mentorship, sort of older missionary with younger missionary on the field who can speak to them on a more sort of culturally sensitive time frame, localized. You know, when we try to talk to missionaries, we're like, what time is it there on the other side of the world? But they would have maybe that sort of more immediate connection that could be an initial half step to deal with a problem before they have to really, you know, dive deep with their local church, and could just be a great mentorship process. So that might be a little change for the missionary's experience, but I don't think it would be a major change. They're still primarily talking to their sending church. Again, this is, this is just in Shane's mind. It's not anything that...
I mean, I would be open, or I think it might be helpful even in church planning efforts. Can you imagine if we're going to do church planning efforts? We got a guy, man, he wants to go to a church in Charlotte, and you know, Carrie and others. So you're more strategic about, hey, anybody got resources? We got a young couple, and it could just really, even in a stateside church plant mode, which could still be considered a mission outreach, how that could, God can use that providentially to bring different pieces together you wouldn't see otherwise.
Yeah. Do we have it, Paul?
On one end, you have a decentralization of the administration away from the organizations, away from the agencies, back to the church, feeding into that. Still, you have this layer of administration. You mentioned that in an earlier session of how that gets done, the visa issues, of all things that go into just getting them on the field, but also sustaining them on the field. How do you envision that in an ideal or in a best practices for the local church in this kind of situation?
Yeah, so the question for the recording, he's asking, you still have, at some point, logistical issues that have to be handled, administrated by somebody somewhere. So in this sort of envisioning, what does that look like? How would that be handled, essentially?
So it's two things. One, if you're using an agency, there are places where we might feel very uncomfortable, ill-equipped to send someone in a more remote location, and we say, man, they need to be part of an organization. But these organizations function independently. They're going to do what they're going to do regardless. So for us to say, here's the conditions. I set a list of here's things you should expect from a mission agency. And so for one, gives us a voice with this agency. Here's what we're going to get this guy. Here's what we want from you. Transparency. Here's what we need. Accountability and agree on things. So there might be, on the missional aspect, that component. Other places, be honest, mission boards sometimes make themselves sound indispensable, and they're really not. Now, raising support, it was more challenging for me to raise support without an agency. It was, because if you get into, agencies get you into their churches and you get their list, that's a little bit easier. On our end, maybe not. Maybe raising support would not be a big issue. But on that end, I think today, I give Europe as an example. Europe, the visa process is pretty straightforward.